A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the stereotype we've all absorbed, that Mediterranean cultures with their big hand gestures and open emotion are somehow happier than the buttoned-up Brits and Scandinavians. And he wants to know whether any research actually supports the thesis that more emotionally open cultures produce happier people. He also raises the vitamin D confound himself, which I appreciate, preempting my questions before I ask them. And then the practical question, if expressiveness does help, what can the rest of us learn from that?
This is one of those questions where the intuition is so strong you almost don't want to test it. It feels true. Of course, getting things off your chest is healthier than bottling them up. But the moment you try to measure this across cultures, everything gets tangled. Climate, economics, what people will even admit on a survey. The data tells a much stranger story.
The Finnish paradox, right off the bat. Finland is ranked number one on the World Happiness Report for 8 consecutive years now. 2026 marks the 8th. And these are not people known for emoting in public. The stereotype is that a Finn will stand 6 feet away from you at a bus stop in silence, and consider that a warm interaction.
Yet they report being happier than Italians, Brazilians, Spaniards. So either the stereotype is wrong, or expressiveness is not doing the work we think it's doing. Let's start with what we're actually testing here. The core thesis would be that cultures with higher emotional expressiveness norms provide more outlets for emotional processing, which reduces the distress that comes from suppression. Plausible, intuitive, and probably too simple.
Why too simple?
Because it assumes that expression is always cathartic and suppression is always harmful, regardless of context. That assumption comes mostly from Western psychology research done on Western subjects, mainly American college students, if we're being honest about the participant pools. When you test it across cultures, the picture fractures. The key paper that really shifted this conversation was Mesquita and Frigida in 1992, looking at cultural variation in emotional experience. They showed that emotions themselves aren't universal in how they're experienced or expressed. Culture shapes the actual phenomenology, not just the display rules.
It's not just that a Japanese person and an Italian person feel the same thing, and one hides it while the other shows it. The feeling itself might be different.
And that's a much deeper claim than most people realize. It means you can't just compare expression levels and assume you're comparing the same underlying emotional experience. Matsumoto and colleagues in 2008 did one of the largest cross-cultural studies on this, looking at display rules and subjective well-being across 32 countries. They found that the relationship between emotional expression and well-being depends entirely on what the local norms actually are. In cultures where expression is normative, expressing predicts well-being. In cultures where restraint is normative, restraint predicts well-being.
It's not about the absolute level of expression. It's about whether you match your surroundings.
That's the cultural fit hypothesis. Delierschneider and colleagues in 2015 published a really elegant set of studies showing that emotional fit, the degree to which your emotional patterns match those of your cultural context, predicts life satisfaction more strongly than absolute expression levels. And it predicts it across both individualist and collectivist cultures. The mechanism seems to be that emotional fit facilitates social connection, and social connection is what actually drives well-being.
Which means if you're a naturally expressive person in Finland, you might actually be worse off than a naturally reserved person in Finland, even though you're healthier. By the Western psychology model.
And that's where the suppression paradox gets interesting. Butler and colleagues in 2007 did a widely cited study showing that emotional suppression has negative social and cognitive consequences. It impairs memory, it raises blood pressure, it makes conversation partners uncomfortable. Classic finding, very robust. But here's the thing, those studies were done in the United States, where suppression is counter-normative. When Soto and colleagues replicated this in 2011 with East Asian participants in contexts where suppression is normative, the negative effects were significantly weaker or absent.
Suppression isn't inherently toxic. It's toxic when your culture says you shouldn't be doing it.
The physiological cost of suppression seems to be partly mediated by the social meaning of the act. If everyone around you is also keeping a lid on it, your body doesn't read the restraint as a stressful act of concealment. It reads it as normal social behavior.
Which means the entire bottling it up is bad for you. Framework is culturally specific. That's a pretty significant caveat for a lot of pop psychology.
It really is. And it complicates the question Daniel raised about whether more open cultures lead to happier people. If the mechanism is cultural fit rather than expression per se, then both open and reserved cultures can produce happy people, as long as individuals are well matched to their context. The problem arises for mismatched individuals and for people in cultures that are in transition or conflict about norms.
Let's talk about the measurement problem, because I think this is where a lot of the confusion comes from. When you see a chart comparing depression rates across countries, what are you actually looking at?
You're looking at a mess. The WHO World Mental Health Survey data from 2004 to 2015 shows lifetime depression prevalence ranging from about 3% in Japan to about 21% in France. That's a sevenfold difference. It's almost certainly not real. When researchers use culturally adapted diagnostic instruments, tools that account for how depression manifests differently in different cultures, the range shrinks dramatically to about 6 to 12%. More than half of that apparent cross-cultural variation is measurement artifact.
What kind of cultural differences in manifestation?
In many East Asian contexts, depression is more likely to present with somatic symptoms, fatigue, pain, sleep disturbance, rather than the psychological symptoms like sadness and guilt that Western diagnostic instruments emphasize. So, if you're using a Western instrument, you'll undercount depression in China or Japan because you're asking the wrong questions. Conversely, in some Mediterranean cultures, intense emotional expression during distress is normative and doesn't necessarily indicate pathology, but it can get coded as such on standardized measures.
The Italians might look more depressed on paper because they're just being Italian.
That's the crude version, but yes. And the Japanese might look less depressed because they're not reporting psychological distress in the way the instrument expects. Neither number means what it seems to mean.
Then there's stigma. In cultures where mental illness carries heavier stigma, people are less likely to endorse symptoms even on anonymous surveys. So you get artificially low prevalence numbers precisely in the places where mental health might actually be worse.
Reporting bias runs in both directions. High stigma cultures underreport. High awareness cultures might overreport as mental health literacy increases and people pathologize normal distress. This is why simple country rankings of depression or happiness are basically meaningless without a deep understanding of local context.
All right, let's talk about the vitamin D confound, because Daniel raised it, and it's a real one. How much of the sunshine happiness link is just biochemistry?
It's non-trivial. Burke and colleagues did a meta-analysis in 2007 showing a consistent correlation between vitamin D deficiency and depression. The mechanism is plausible. Vitamin D receptors are expressed throughout the brain, including areas involved in mood regulation. And sunlight exposure drives vitamin D synthesis, so Mediterranean climates do provide a genuine physiological advantage independent of any cultural expressiveness effects.
How do researchers try to disentangle this?
A few ways. One is to compare countries at similar latitudes but with different cultural expressiveness norms, say Spain versus Japan, which are at roughly similar latitudes. Another is to look at within-country variation. If you compare northern versus southern Italy, you can hold culture relatively constant while varying sunlight exposure. The European Social Survey data from 2002 to 2020 is useful here because it tracks both life satisfaction and emotional expression norms across dozens of countries over time.
What does that show?
That both matter, but culture seems to be the stronger predictor once you control for climate. The Nordic countries have terrible sunlight for much of the year and yet consistently top the happiness rankings. Meanwhile, Greece and Portugal have abundant sunlight but score lower on well-being measures, likely due to economic factors, particularly the aftermath of the 2008 debt crisis.
Economics can overwhelm both sunlight and cultural expressiveness.
Greece scores lower than Sweden on the WHO 5 well-being index, despite being more expressive and sunnier. When people can't find work and the economy is contracting, cultural norms around emotional expression are not going to rescue your mental health. The European Social Survey Round 10 from 2020 has Denmark at a mean life satisfaction of 8.4 out of 10, and Portugal at 6.2. Denmark is famously reserved. Portugal is famously warm and expressive. The expressiveness advantage, if it exists at all, is not strong enough to overcome economic headwinds.
There's also the temperature emotion hypothesis, which I hadn't heard of before digging into this. What's that about?
Wei and colleagues in 2017 found that higher ambient temperature correlates with higher emotional expressiveness in social interactions, but also with higher aggression. So warmth might make people more expressive, but not necessarily in a way that improves well-being. The physiological arousal from heat might lower the threshold for emotional display generally, both positive and negative. You get more laughter and more arguments.
Which means the expressiveness of Mediterranean cultures might be partly a byproduct of climate rather than a cultural achievement. People aren't more open because their culture taught them to be. They're more open because it's hot and their bodies are less inhibited.
That's the hypothesis. It's hard to prove causally, but it's consistent with the data. And it would mean that trying to import Mediterranean expressiveness into a cold climate by sheer cultural will might not work, or might not produce the same effects.
Let's dig into the individualism versus collectivism confound, because this one took me a minute to wrap my head around. The expressive cultures we're talking about, Southern Europe, Latin America, tend to be more collectivist than the reserved Northern European cultures. But collectivism usually emphasizes social harmony over individual emotional expression. So, how do you square that?
This is one of the most counterintuitive findings in the literature. Triandis, in 2001, laid this out clearly. Collectivist cultures do prioritize social harmony, but they often achieve it through different emotional strategies depending on the specific cultural context. In some collectivist cultures, like Japan, harmony is maintained through emotional restraint. In others, like Brazil or Italy, harmony is maintained through emotional engagement, clearing the air, expressing warmth, maintaining social connection through display.
Both are collectivist strategies, just different flavors.
And this is why you can't just plot countries on an expressiveness axis and a collectivism axis and expect a clean correlation. The relationship between individualism and expressiveness varies by region. In East Asia, collectivism correlates with restraint. In Latin America and Southern Europe, collectivism correlates with expressiveness. The cultural logic is different.
Which makes the whole expressive equals healthier thesis even harder to test. You can't just control for individualism, because individualism itself interacts with expressiveness differently in different places.
And that's before we even get to the genetic confounds. There's some evidence that populations differ in serotonin transporter gene variants that influence emotional reactivity. If Italians are genetically more reactive, they might be both more expressive and more prone to mood variability, which could cancel out any expressiveness benefit at the population level.
After all these confounds, measurement bias, vitamin D, temperature, economics, individualism, genetics, what's the most robust finding that actually survives?
The cultural consonance model. Dressler and colleagues in 2005 articulated this, and it's held up well. The idea is that individuals whose emotional behavior matches their cultural context report better mental health, regardless of whether that context is expressive or reserved. It's not about what you do, it's about whether what you do fits where you are.
The question isn't, should I be more expressive? The question is, am I expressing in a way that works in my context?
That's the takeaway. And it explains both the Finnish paradox and the Greek puzzle. Finns are happy not despite their reserve, but partly because their reserve fits their context. Greeks are less happy not because they're expressive, but because economic stress undermines well-being regardless of expressiveness.
Let's talk about the trade-offs of high expressiveness, because I think the pop narrative tends to romanticize it. What are the downsides?
The first is social friction. In cultures that value emotional expressiveness, conflicts can escalate more quickly because emotional displays amplify rather than contain disagreement. If everyone is expected to show what they feel, a minor disagreement can become a major confrontation because the emotional volume turns up the stakes.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure that analogy works, but I take your point. The second downside is emotional exhaustion. Constant expressiveness can be draining, especially for individuals who are naturally more reserved. If your culture demands emotional performance, big greetings, visible enthusiasm, open distress, and you're an introvert, you're essentially doing emotional labor all day. In highly expressive cultures, the line between appropriate disclosure and oversharing can be blurry. What counts as healthy openness in one context becomes social burden in another. The person who tells you their entire life story on a first meeting might be charming in Naples and alarming in Helsinki.
There's also the conflict with professional environments. Global business culture tends to favor Northern European reserve, which means people from expressive cultures can face discrimination in international settings, seen as unprofessional or volatile.
That's a real problem, and it's asymmetrical. Reserved people in expressive cultures might be seen as cold or untrustworthy, but expressive people in reserved cultures are often penalized more harshly. The global professional norm has drifted toward restraint.
All right, let's shift to the practical. Daniel asked what we can learn from all this, even if the simple thesis doesn't hold. If you're someone living in a less expressive culture, and you want the mental health benefits that expression is supposed to provide, what do you do?
The key insight from the cultural fit research is that you don't need to become a different person in public. What you need is congruence plus safe outlets. The expressive writing paradigm from James Pennebaker is the classic here. His 1997 analysis showed that 15 to 20 minutes of writing about emotional experiences for 3 to 5 sessions produces roughly a 30% reduction in doctor visits for physical illness over the following months.
30% is not trivial.
It's enormous. And the mechanism is fascinating. It's not that writing replaces social support. It's that the act of translating emotional experience into language, even with no audience, seems to reorganize the cognitive processing of the event. You're not venting, you're structuring.
The benefit isn't from getting it out, in the catharsis sense. It's from making sense of it.
Catharsis models, the Freudian idea that expressing emotion releases psychic pressure, have not held up well in research. What works is cognitive processing, naming, sequencing, understanding. That can happen in conversation, but it can also happen alone on a page.
Which means even in a culture where you can't emote publicly, you're not doomed to poor mental health. You just need a private practice.
Ideally, one or two close relationships where deliberate emotional disclosure is possible. The research suggests that the quality of disclosure matters more than the quantity. A single trusted confidant with whom you can be fully honest is protective, even if your public presentation is reserved. This is how many people in Nordic cultures manage it. Public restraint, private depth.
What about the flip side? If you're in an expressive culture, what's the risk and what's the skill?
The risk is emotional oversharing and social friction. The skill is reading context, knowing when expression serves connection and when it creates conflict. In expressive cultures, the person who knows when not to express has a real advantage. They're not suppressing in the harmful sense. They're exercising emotional regulation with cultural awareness.
The skill in both contexts is the same, just applied differently, knowing when to express and when to regulate, based on what the situation actually calls for.
That's emotional intelligence in a culturally grounded sense, not a universal set of rules, but the ability to read your specific context and calibrate accordingly. And this is something that can be learned. It's not just a personality trait.
One thing that strikes me about this research is how much it undermines the self-help industry's universal prescriptions. Be more open. Share your feelings. Vulnerability is strength. These are presented as universal truths, but they're culturally specific advice that might actually harm someone in a context where that behavior is counter-normative.
Brené Brown's work on vulnerability, for instance, is deeply embedded in an American cultural framework where individualism and self-disclosure are valued. That doesn't make it wrong. It's well supported within that context. But exporting it wholesale to Japan or Finland without cultural adaptation is irresponsible. The same behavior that builds trust in Texas might erode trust in Tokyo.
Yet the global reach of American media and self-help content means these norms are being exported whether they fit or not.
Which brings us to the open question. As global culture homogenizes through media and migration, are emotional expression norms converging? And if they are, what does that mean for mental health?
My guess is we're seeing a shift toward greater expressiveness, at least among younger generations exposed to global social media norms. The question is whether that shift is creating more cultural misfits. People whose expression style no longer matches their local context because they've adopted norms from a different context.
That's the cultural fit hypothesis in reverse. If you're a teenager in a traditionally reserved culture who has absorbed American expressiveness norms from TikTok and Instagram, you might find yourself mismatched with your family and local community. The expressiveness itself isn't the problem, the mismatch is.
Which could explain some of the rising mental health issues among young people globally. It's not just that social media is bad for you in some direct way. It's that it's importing emotional norms that may not fit your local context, creating a kind of cultural dislocation.
That's speculative but plausible. The other big factor is the rise of teletherapy and digital mental health tools. These create new spaces for emotional expression that transcend local cultural norms. If you're in a reserved culture and you're doing therapy via an app with a therapist in a different cultural context, you're essentially operating in a third space with its own norms.
Which could be liberating or destabilizing, depending on how it's handled.
The potential upside is that people in restrictive contexts get access to emotional outlets they wouldn't otherwise have. The potential downside is that the cultural dislocation we just talked about gets amplified. You learn to express in therapy, but then return to a context where that expression doesn't work, and now you're even more frustrated.
Let's pull this together into something actionable. If I'm a listener who's been absorbing the express more, feel better message, and I'm now wondering whether that applies to me. What should I actually do?
First, assess your cultural context honestly. Not the global context, not the internet context, your actual daily social environment. What are the norms? What happens to people who deviate from them? Not what should happen, what actually happens.
Second, distinguish between public expression and private processing. You can do the Pennebaker Writing Protocol in complete privacy. You can have one trusted relationship where you're fully open while maintaining cultural appropriateness in public. These aren't contradictions.
Third, if you're in an expressive culture, the skill to develop is not more expression, it's contextual judgment. When does expression help, and when does it make things worse? The person who can read the room has an advantage over the person who just lets it all out indiscriminately.
Fourth, if you're in a reserve culture, don't pathologize your restraint. The data doesn't support the idea that you're damaging yourself by being reserved if that reserve fits your context. The damage comes from feeling like you have to hide who you are, not from being someone who processes internally.
The distinction is between chosen restraint and enforced suppression. If your reserve is authentic to you and fits your environment, it's not suppression, it's just who you are. The research supports that.
One more thing worth saying. The cultural fit model implies that there's no single right way to be emotionally healthy. The Finnish way works in Finland. The Italian way works in Italy. Problems arise when people are forced to operate by norms that don't fit them, or when they internalize norms from a different culture and feel perpetually inadequate by local standards.
That's the deeper takeaway. The question isn't, are expressive cultures happier? The question is, does your emotional style fit your life? If it does, you're probably fine regardless of where you fall on the expressiveness spectrum. If it doesn't, the solution isn't necessarily to become more expressive or more reserved. It's to find or create context where your natural style fits.
Which circles back to Daniel's original intuition. He was right to be skeptical of the simple story, and he was right to raise the confounds. The data supports his skepticism. But the practical question he asked, what can we learn about the value of being open, has a real answer. Being open helps when it's authentic to you and appropriate to your context. It doesn't help when it's forced or mismatched.
The research on expressive writing suggests that even private openness, openness with yourself, has measurable benefits. You don't need an audience to get the cognitive benefits of emotional processing.
The vitamin D confound is real. The economics confound is real. The measurement confound is real. But underneath all of that, the core insight is about fit, not about expression levels. That's more nuanced than the pop psychology version, but also more useful.
It's also more hopeful in a way. It means you're not doomed by your culture. If you're reserved in an expressive culture or expressive in a reserve culture, you're not broken. You just need to find your people and your outlets. The goal isn't to change who you are to match your context. The goal is to find the overlap between who you are and where you can thrive.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, the Tang Dynasty had been over for nearly 8 centuries, but Mongolian bureaucrats still used a ceremonial seal-carving technique originally designed for Tang imperial edicts, a procedure that survived only because a single family of scribes passed it down in secret for 27 generations. The last practitioner died in 1693 without an heir, and the technique vanished.
27 generations of keeping a stamp-carving method alive, and then one person forgets to have kids, and it's gone.
The fragility of cultural transmission in a single fact.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It genuinely helps. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.